She's now a cultural historian at the Smithsonian Institution. She's in Philadelphia for a performance tonight at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum, which is located at 7th and Arch Streets. The performance will be at 8 o'clock, and if you'd like any information about it, you can call the museum, and the number is 574-3696. 574-3696. Before we meet Bernice Reagan, let's listen to one of her political songs. This is a song about Joanne Little. We'll hear a recording from the first Sweet Honey in the Rock album.
Who is this girl and what is she to you, Joanne Little? She's my sister, Joanne Little. She's our mama, Joanne Little. She's your lover, Joanne's a woman who's born to carry your child.
Well, I've always been told since the day I was born, leave them no good women alone. Child, you better keep your nose clean, keep your butt off the street. You gon' be judged by the company you keep. And they always walk by the golden rule. Steer clear of controversy, I stay real cool. Till along came this woman, little over 5 feet tall, charged and jailed with breaking the law. And the next thing I heard as it came on the news, first degree murder, she was on the loose. Tell me who is this girl?
Talking about the roaring west, this was 1975 at its most oppressive best. North Carolina State, the pride of this land, made her an outlaw, hunted on every hand. Tell me, what did she do to deserve his name? Killed a man who thought that she was fair game. When I heard the news, I screamed inside. Lost all my cool, my anger, I could not hide. Cause now Joanne is you, and Joanne is me. Our prison is the whole society. Cause we live in a land that brings our pressure to bear on the head of a woman whose position we share. Tell me who is this girl?
Joanne Little, a song by my guest Bernice Reagan, featured on the first Sweet Honey in the Rock album. Bernice Reagan, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me here. It's good to be in the city.
Let me ask you how you first got interested in political songs and in the use of song as an inspiring thing and a politically inspiring thing.
It would be the Civil Rights Movement, Albany, Georgia, 1961. I was a junior at Albany State College, and we did our first demonstration. And when we got back to the church, somebody said, "Bernice, sing a song." And I sang a song that up to that point I'd sung as "Over My Head, I See Trouble in the Air." And I started the song, and it went, "Over my head, I see." But I didn't see any trouble at that point, and I changed trouble to freedom in the air. And that was my first experience with using music to articulate something I felt inside that was directly connected to a political radical act that I'd taken.
You were one of the founding members of a group called the Freedom Singers that was affiliated with SNCC in the 1960s. How did that group come about?
The genesis of that group is the Albany Movement. The Albany Movement, I'm from Southwest Georgia. Albany is sort of the center of a collection of area that's actually black belt because the blacks outnumber whites in that area of the South. The Albany Movement was known for the music from the mass meetings and the jails and the rallies. And the Freedom Singers were formed by Cordell Regan, who I later married. And Cordell had worked all over the South. When he put together the group, he pulled two people from Albany, myself and Ruth Harris, and Charles Neblett was from Illinois. These were people he had met as he moved across the South doing work as a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was the radical vanguard civil rights movement group of that movement. But the essence and the power or the thing that made people know that music could be very important was the Albany movement. Because when people wrote about the movement, they always wrote about the music. And the Freedom Singers went across this country singing about what was happening in the South when we couldn't get stories on what was happening in the South.
What were some of the songs that you did then?
Songs I'd done all my life. This Little Light of Mine, We Shall Not Be Moved. I'll Overcome, which was We Shall Overcome Then. Hold On, Keep Your Eyes on the Prize, Hold On. And we call them freedom songs. Sometimes the songs would be, one word would change. I'm on my way to Canaan land, I'm on my way to freedom land. Sometimes there were new songs written. A songwriter named Matthew Jones out of New York, who's now in New York, came out of Tennessee, and he was a songwriter. He wrote new songs. By and large, I sang songs, and this first group sang songs that were traditional and being used on the street.
You have done a lot of research into how some of the songs developed and how they grew within the civil rights movement and what happened with them. Let's talk about some specific songs and discuss a little bit some of the things that you found out about the songs themselves. I know that one of the tunes that you did look into was We Shall Overcome. Where is that tune from? Like, how did that become a part of the civil rights movement?
A lot of the songs are traditional songs, and they were in traditional black church repertoire. And at some point, moved on to various stages of the political arena. We Shall Overcome, as far as I've been able to find out, to this point, the first time it was used politically was in Charleston, South Carolina, by tobacco workers who were striking. They began to organize the late 20s into the 30s, their most heated strikes taking place in the 40s. But from the late 20s when they organized, they said this was always a favorite song. When they went to the picket line, they said this was actually their theme song. And the song was taken to Highlander Folk Center, which was a school, almost an adult education center, that had a lot to do with training people to organize around labor issues. And it was used at Highlander. And then in the 60s, Highlander turned its attention to the civil rights movement issue and began to train civil rights movement workers. And whatever song repertoire Highlander had been holding was transferred. And this song was transferred to the Fisk and Tennessee A&I students from Nashville who were having a sit-in during the early 60s. And they took it back. And it was at the organizing meeting for SNCC in 1960 that people say that when they stood to sing this song, suddenly everybody joined hands. And that for at that moment, the elevation of this song as the theme song of the civil rights movement occurred. In this instance, you're talking about a song that is Black traditional. The first time it is used politically, it is used by Black workers. It is almost held in some kind of reservoir for a period of years and almost returned to another Black political situation. So that it's an interesting development. Another song that's similar is We Shall Not Be Moved, which is a Black church song that was picked up by the labor unions, picked up again by the civil rights movement workers. This song did not go through the Highlander conduit. There's another song, Which Side Are You On?, that was written by Florence Reese during the labor movement. Florence Reese is white and from Kentucky. James Farmer is Black and was the head of CORE. His politicalization occurred in Chicago during the 40s. He learned that song at some point during the 40s in his labor and pacifist work. When he went on his freedom ride to Jackson, Mississippi, he changed the verses so that that song that Florence Reese had written about her strike and hazard became a song that talked about the problems that happened on the freedom rides.
How did you trace these things?
Oral history, interviews. I was lucky enough with We Shall Overcome to go back to some of the people who organized the Black Union in Charleston, and I interviewed them. And then you go back to documents, you look at copyright records, you find every notation of We Shall Overcome you can find anywhere, and you try to trace it down.
Is there a copyright on We Shall Overcome?
Yes.
Whose name is on it?
We Shall Overcome is copyrighted by four people. Zilphia Horton was music director at Highlander at the time the song was brought there in the 30s. And Pete Seeger learned the song from Zilphia in the 40s. Pete Seeger taught the song to Frank, can't remember his last name, and then Guy Carawan. So there are four people on there. I think at the time it was copyrighted, Zilphia Horton was dead. Miles Horton, who was her husband and head of Highlander, agreed that her name could go on it only if all of the funds were put in a fund and would be returned to the movement. They wanted to put it on Zilphia's name on it because that is where Pete Seeger had gotten the song. And Zilphia was seen as the key person who had kept the song in Highlander and had had it published in People's Song, and so key to the fact that it was still around when the Nashville people came. The other people identified verses, I think, that they had sort of added. Like, it was, I will overcome or we will overcome, and Pete turned it to we shall. Things of that sort. And out of that, they set up the copyright. One of the tragedies of this copyright is that the politicalization of the song occurred from a Black union. The elevation of the song to worldview as a political struggle song occurred again from a Black struggle. There are no Black people on the copyright. The good thing about the copyright is that there is a We Shall Overcome fund that by its structure requires that there be two people on the committee at all time who participated in that movement, and that the funds that come in from the royalties of this song will go to Black cultural issues that blend culture and struggle in the South. And so it's like one of those things that have some historical pain and exploitation in it, actually, but also some benefits because it the fun is there.
How would you have liked to see the copyright handled?
I'm now in the process of trying to release an anthology of civil rights movement songs. A lot of them were during the mass meetings. And I'm trying to systematically locate people. I'll be having a conference at Smithsonian on the culture of the civil rights movement in late January, early February 1980. We will have 30 song leaders there. I will ask them to address the issue and see if we can get a joint copyright with the funds going into the same fund. So that, for instance, Woke Up This Morning is copyrighted by the Weavers, which is amazing. But I think these things happen. Usually a record company, if you record a record and they can't find a copyright, their publishing company owned then said this arrangement is copyrighted by. The song you can't do that with at this point is We Shall Overcome. No matter how you sing it, the money goes into this fund.
What has happened to most of these songs? And most of the songs that you've been tracing being sung in places now at rallies or at concerts or any functions?
These songs were wherever they were when we used them. And that's what we did. We used them for a purpose. When we no longer did that purpose, you know, why should they become museum documents? I do the songs if I'm doing a historical presentation. So I'll do some of the songs tonight because I'll be trying to do a history. And I think the songs teach about that period. But a lot of them are in churches. Or if you do a rundown on your station of music from the 50s, you'll see Ray Charles Hit the Road Jack, or you'll see Lil Willie John, You Better Leave My Kitten Alone, as it was recorded. So those songs are back where they were until we need to use them again. And if we had to use them again, we may not pull the same ones.
No, but there are songs that survive, maybe not on the radio as hit tunes, but in people's memories and in record collections over decades, like Billie Holiday and Louis Armstrong. Their music was not specific to a period. For some people it is, but for some people it certainly isn't. And the songs that they've sung continue to be an important part of musicians' repertoires. What did you think musically of the songs of the civil rights movement?
I think it's one of the most exciting musical statements we have on Black American culture and how it works. A song like We Shall Overcome leapt from the culture and is used in struggles all over the world. And so when people get ready to fight, the first thing they do is translate We Shall Overcome and start singing it. That is wonderful. You will still find songs like This Little Light of Mine, We Shall Not Be Moved, that seem to be central to any decision to take a stand on an issue. The music of the civil rights movement gives a person a chance to look at how Black music culture works. Because the music was not spread through the record industry or sheet music. The process was oral and visual. To some extent, it was assisted by news coverage, but the DJs had nothing to do with it. And so at this point, you're looking at an oral process expanded by a technological hookup that was also oral and visual. And you have a chance to see maybe where we get the spirituals from. I think the study of the civil rights movement will teach us a lot about songs, choral expression, the voice of the group of people that we see very little of today, or people are very confused about whether this statement is political or is it just somebody wanting to go to heaven when they die. And I feel with that period, I'm able to look at and go back and talk to people to determine what this music was and what political analysis is present in the singing of a song.
Is there a political music now that really interests you?
We've been using political in a narrow sense. I need to say that everything is political. If you don't know what political lines some act you're doing is pushing, it's probably because you're not pushing your own. And you're probably pushing against your own if you're not conscious of it. I am interested in all music that seem to address issues of survival and struggle and quality of life. I study specifically Black American music. Other musics in this country now are being created. Some of the most exciting stuff is happening with Indian struggles in this country, where you're getting a pan-Indian kind of music that's being done with special drums, crossing the tribes, real unity kind of statement. A lot of folklorists have trouble with this move because they say it's destroying the specific culture of the specific people. I think that with the threat Indians are facing now that we found that they have uranium and all of this stuff on that grand land that wouldn't grow anything else, which is why we gave it to them, with the threat that's facing them, the music they're creating, this pan-Indian music, is indicating that their political strategy has to address banding together across their nation lines. Another place you can find music is in the Chicano struggles, and you can find music in all from all over Latin American communities. One of the most powerful music cultures present in this country is women's music that is, to a large extent, white women's music. This is not only the songs that are sung, but almost an alternative circuit where there are record companies, there are production companies, there are sound people, where women have really organized and tried to address their needs for culture. Sweet Honey's second album was done by Redwood Record Company, which is a company started by Holly Nia in California that does produces Holly's record and the Sweet Honey record.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes, but maybe this is a good time to listen to another selection from the first Sweet Honey and the Rock record. Before we hear it, let me remind you that my guest is Bernice Reagan, who is a founder of Sweet Honey and the Rock. She's also a cultural historian now at the Smithsonian Institution, and she's doing considerable research, as she explained, into the songs of the civil rights movement. She's in Philadelphia for a performance tonight at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum on 7th and Art Streets. And for information about this concert, which begins at 8, you can call the museum, and their number is 574-3696. This is the women of Sweet Honey and the Rock singing Jesus Is My Only Friend.
Jesus, Jesus is my only friend. Jesus, Jesus is my only friend. Jesus, Jesus is my only friend. Jesus is my only friend. Ah, when the doctor man give me out, when the Jesus is my only friend.
Jesus Is My Only Friend is featured on the first Sweet Honey in the Rock record. My guest Bernice Reagan was the lead vocalist on that recording. Bernice, do you want to say a few words about the song that we just heard?
Yeah, that song belongs to a family of traditional songs that I grew up with. As a singer who has a political and cultural consciousness, a large part of my repertoire are songs that have been handed to me from my family or older members of my community. And this is one. And a lot of times people say, well, why do you do such a wide range? And what I say is that I am a complex person. I am not just today. I am everything that I have ever been. And even before that, before I have been, I am that also. And doing a song like this and feeling it is one of the most stabilizing things I do for myself. And anytime I hear it, I just feel like I get identified as a people past the boundaries of anything that's happening to me now. Whatever Black people are right now in the United States or whatever we were in slavery, that kind of sound, that choral power, music power, puts me in a line with Black people centuries, years old. And it makes me know who I am, clear of any particular condition. And it's really special to also do that music.
Special to hear it. As as someone who is not connected to the culture, obviously, in the way that you are, it's still, it's really moving and exciting to hear. Let me ask you, Bernice, if for you, women's issues and Black issues are connected in any way?
I'm a Black woman, so the issues are not separate for me. Black women in this country have had to do some, to live life or to carry a kind of load that had something to do with the survival of the people, that took them outside of the narrow parameters being drawn by whoever drew up where women were supposed to be in the first position. So in one instance, Black women were never even allowed to stand in those narrow holes. We had other kinds of oppressive holes that we had to stand in. So that our struggle for humanism and our struggle for improving our opportunities as individual women comes from a history of having to do a certain kind of living and working and surviving that was killing, a killing burden. A burden that said you give up everything you are so that your people will be here the next day. And so that our struggles come from that and they are not separate. It has everything to do with being a Black person in the United States.
How do you react to the fact that historically when men had the vote first, then white men had the vote first, then Black men had the vote, and white women and Black women together weren't able to vote. Like, where does that fit in for you and your politics?
Well, there's another breakdown. White women got the vote in the late 20s. And I guess some Black women got the vote at that time. But in the 60s, Black people, men and women, were being killed for trying to vote. So that, you know, the breakdown just keeps breaking down. And it is, it just demonstrates how complex the analogy must be and that to do simplistic grouping does not help at all. So that to say black and white women are together is to ignore historical reality. Our histories are different. It is clear that all over this world, and I don't know societies that do not oppress women, all over this world, women are trying to deal with what they need to affirm their humanness and affirm what they have to do in order to be individual human beings and not be bracketed by somebody else's slot, usually men. But in every instance, there are some points that connect us together across cultures, but there are some points that oppose us. I remember the first time somebody wanted me to talk to a conscious raising session. This is late 60s, I guess, in Atlanta. And she says, "We are conscious raisers." And I said, "What are you raising conscious for?" And she said, "Women's rights and women's liberation." And I'd not really heard much about it at that point. I was a really staunch black nationalist and was really out of what was happening in white women's groups. And so because of an activist, they thought it would be important. So I said, "Well, what are women's rights?" And she says, "Well, that women really could do more than wash dishes, change diapers, you know, that kind of work." One, she was simplifying it so that I would understand what they were struggling for. But what she was feeding me was work I was not able to do for my children. I was a woman alone running my house, and I was in the street all the time working. And I never had time to wash my dishes or change my baby's diapers or any of that stuff, and I longed to do it. And I said, "I wish somebody would give me a break so I could get to do that work." And so I think you get those kinds of complexities whenever you deal with women's issues. And so I think we have that range of thing happening.
A lot of white women who were politically active in the late 60s in the anti-war movement and the radical student movement felt that they were really shortchanged by the men who were the leaders of that movement, and that somehow the women ended up stuffing envelopes with political brochures for political mailings and doing a lot of the office-type organizational work and being the women for the heavy political men. Did you ever feel that kind of shortchanging in the movement? Because I know some people have expressed that feeling.
There are two things. One is that the radical movements of the 60s rest on the civil rights movement. This whole period that's boomeranging through the women's movement, the gay, lesbian movement, the peace movement, the student movement, the Indian, the Chicanos, all of that sets on the foundation as the civil rights movement. You can trace all of those struggles back to that movement. And therefore, all of those things exist as a continuum of the civil rights movement. So when people say, "It's dead," I said, "Well, take a look, it's still here." Of course, many of those people who are working in those movements do not acknowledge that connection, and they have no idea that connection is there because they don't think they look like civil rights movement workers because they're not black. The other thing around ripoffs of women in political struggle has to do with whether or not it is struggle that addresses sexism. If it does not, chances are women are going to be exploited. I'm not sure why women seem to be so amazed that these struggles also exploited them as all others. They seem to think that since these struggles were addressing issues in certain directions, say equality and for all people, that it was supposed to affect them. If you have a political analysis that does not address all issues, it doesn't. And women are not going to be free from sexism through some kind of fallout. Women will only end exploitation when they decide it will not ever go on again. That was not a call that we issued. And therefore, it was not addressed. The concern, the consciousness for all of these groups began then. It was the civil rights movement that made you see yourself not only as a black oppressed person, but also as a woman. Or not only see yourself as a white person helping black people be free, but a student who is really getting ripped off. Or a white woman helping black people became sensitive to the exploitation she experienced as a white woman. The same thing happened with a lot of Hispanic people who participated in the movement. You become sensitized not only to black oppression, but whatever your own oppression is. And many a time, you're being oppressed by the circle that is formed to fight the named oppression. So you get together, so you're going to end this particular oppression over here. And then when your sensitivity rises, you find that the other co-workers have got their foot on your neck. Well, it's not going to move just because they can see this bigotry over here does not mean they can see their own. Somebody's got their foot on your neck. To a large extent, it is your responsibility to knock it off or break it or whatever you need to do. And I can understand the level of pain people feel because they say, well, if you could see that bigotry, you should see what you're doing to me. Bigotry doesn't run that way. You know, being aware of your own bigotry is the last thing. It's like an alcoholic. The last person you know that you're an alcoholic is you. Everybody else knows it. Bigotry runs the same way. You're the last to discover your own bigotry. And so a lot of women who are talking about exploitation during this period seem to be thinking that these men were supposed to know they were sexual bigots.
I think a lot of the women at the time didn't realize there was a problem either.
I think they know now because everybody's telling them. But when you tell somebody that that's really sexist, they look at you and they say, well, how? Or they run. Or, you know, nobody wants to be. But it's really like it's just chained into the way you're born. You're raised being running the world. I mean, it's from the first time somebody finds out that your body is built a certain way. You are raised then to know that the world is yours. When do you ever wake up that it might be different? Somebody has to hit you across the head, and that's what I think women are doing. But I think that's the way it will be dealt with.
Bernice, we're almost out of time, so I just want to ask you briefly. I know that there's a lot of women in Philadelphia who really have such incredible admiration for Sweet Honey and the Rocks music and will turn up in great numbers to hear you all perform. Is that connection an important one for the group, or is that a nice thing but not necessarily what you had in mind?
When we think of Philadelphia, I don't just think of the women in Philadelphia. Philadelphia has a lot of black people in it. And what is exciting about this event tonight is that it is at a black institution that is celebrating the history of my people. And I do hope that some of the women who have supported Sweet Honey will come to the program, because I think it will be an interesting expansion. So that Philadelphia is a city of women who've given us support. It is also a rich city of black people. Well, and also Rizzo that I hope you're taking care of properly.
Let me tell you where the concert will be this evening. It's at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum, which is at 7th and Arch Streets. The concert is at 8. And if you'd like to call about ticket prices and any further information, you can call the museum. The number is 574-3696. Again, it's at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum, 574-3696. We're going to go out, Bernice, with another selection from A Sweet Honey and the Rock record, and this is going to be from your newer record, the one on Redwood Records, and it's called The Seven Principles. Before we hear it, do you want to say a few words about this?
Seven Principles are based on principles of Kwanzaa, and the words are in Swahili, and the song is actually the Swahili words with the transition. Kwanzaa is an Afro-American celebration that's based on some principles that were pulled together from African community. Nyerere of Tanzania provided a lot of the genesis of the ideas for the principles. Nyerere said that there are two things. Everything we need to liberate ourselves, a present in black traditional society, he's talking about African socialism. He said there are also things that we must leave there because they are repressive. And he said there were two things he would struggle against that were present in traditional society. One was poverty, the other was the oppression of women. This is Seven Principles.
Bernice Reagan, thanks so much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Umoja,
unity that brings us together.
Seven Principles, sung by Sweet Honey and the Rock with Bernice Reagan, who's in Philadelphia to perform tonight at the Afro-American Historical and Cultural Museum.